what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
What's the buzz? How do I resist that?
Don't.
Really?
Don't hold back.
Well, there were a bunch of busybodies on the freeway this morning. The buzz literally is the buzz, because this morning a semi overturned and spilled millions of bees.
First fish, now bees.
That's right.
That's real. Next. Pacific Northwest stuff.
Wildlife on the roads, on the freeways. This is KOW's Week in Review. Hi, happy Friday. I'm Bill Radke. That is Bill Finkbeiner, former State Senate Majority Leader. Republican Finkbeiner, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Hannah Brooks Olson is a writer at Seattle-ish, a blog devoted to Seattle news and culture, brought to you by a trio of mouthy broads.
That's me.
And you're one of them?
I am one of three.
Not a Republican?
Not a Republican.
Not close?
I would say not in the region, no.
And none of your business what his political persuasion is, because he's a journalist. C.R. Douglas.
Independent, Bill Radke.
An independent, thank you. Q13 Fox independent political analyst C.R. Douglas. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Hi.
So let's get to the top stories of the week. The CEO of the Seattle credit card processing company, Gravity Payments, told his employees they will be getting a big raise.
You might be making $35,000 a year right now, but everyone in here will definitely be making $70,000 a year, and I'm super excited about that.
Minimum wage at this guy's company, $70,000 a year. This is against the backdrop of calls for higher wages, complaints about extravagant CEO pay. This guy, Dan Price, says he was reading an article about happiness that said that unlimited money doesn't buy happiness. But if you earn less than about $70,000, extra money means a lot. So he decided, it starts with me. I am raising everybody's salary. The average is $48,000 in his company. Many, many people will get their salary doubled. So $70,000 minimum wage. He's being hailed nationwide as a CEO hero. Is this a new model for American capitalism? What do you think, Hannah?
I mean, I sure hope so. I think a lot of people are asking, you know, how can you pay all of your employees $70,000 a year? I'm asking, how can you afford to live in the city of Seattle at under $70,000 a year, especially if you're maybe in your mid-20s, early 30s, you're hoping to start a family, you have student debt. Everyone's asking why millennials aren't buying houses, because we don't have any money. And so I think people are going to do most of the time the absolute bare minimum that they have to do, and especially business owners sort of fall into this, and that's why we have a minimum wage, is because otherwise people are going to pay as little as they can get away with. And so I hope this is a new standard. I want to see more of this.
But this is the idea of classical capitalism, is I pay you as little as I can, you demand the most you can get, and we come together. And up to now it's been liberals saying that's immoral, but does anyone think, with all the low wage, income inequality protest, is moves like this, is this becoming a consensus that workers deserve more, CR?
I don't think you're suddenly going to see a rush to $70,000 as a minimum wage, but I do think this is a data point in a new trend. I think the era of bare minimum pay capitalism is over, and there is a new ethic, if you will, to be more pro-worker.
What's your evidence for that?
Look, at Walmart went to $10 minimum wage. Company-wide, Target went to $10. IKEA went to $10. All these companies in the last 6 or 8 months. McDonald's went to $1 over minimum wage in all their locations. So you are seeing a shift, and I think this is one example of it. This guy's an outlier in terms of kind of how generous he wants to be. But I think the feeling is that it's not just about how little you can pay, because there are drawbacks and problems when you go to the bare minimum pay.
Like what?
Well, listen, worker retention is tough. Mm-hmm. Productivity is tough. And I think you're seeing companies realize that treating workers better does help their business in the long run.
Republican Bill Finkbeiner, do you disagree?
Absolutely not. No, I think I agree on both counts. First of all, I think that especially smaller, privately held companies, and especially when they start doing better financially. I mean, this guy's an incredible businessman. The story of how he started the company was great. He was in a rock band. He saw somebody having trouble processing their credit cards, and then he starts a business, and it's hugely successful. So I think that privately held, just like CR was saying, you know, when people are paid the bare minimum, you get lots of problems. And I think that it's the bigger companies and more typically publicly held companies that will sort of drive that bottom line mentality. I think that smaller—
Because their shareholders demand it.
Because their shareholders demand it. And because when you're a privately held company, your employees more likely, you have a relationship with them. You see them. It's a smaller company. It's not 50,000 people. It's, you know, maybe a couple hundred or less. And they're, you know, they're people that they know. And they also probably value more the reputation of their company. And at the end of the day, they're not responsible to shareholders. They're responsible to themselves. I mean, I don't think we'll see a lot of, you know, people doing what he's done. But I do think that we're starting to see a shift. And I think the other thing that's going on is our economy, obviously, it's getting stronger. Now we're seeing unemployment rate fall. I think, you know, hopefully wages are on their way up, especially here in the Puget Sound.
I think also when you talk about, you know, tenets of capitalism, like, I think isn't competition one of them as well? And when you become a company who pays, who is known for paying your employees well, people are going to seek out those jobs. And people, you know, there's this big talk about the ability gap between what employers need and how they're having a hard time finding employees who have the right skills. And so when you become a company that people know pays well, you're going to attract a higher caliber. And I think from a capitalistic standpoint, that's super smart.
So what about the bigger picture of CEO pay? Because this Seattle CEO said something very interesting. He said, the market rate for me as a CEO compared to a regular person is ridiculous. It's absurd. Again, this is running against, what, a generation of rising and rising and rising stellar CEO pay. Do we think that is beginning to change too?
I don't think so. I think he's going to set a small example, but whether it will ripple is a bigger question. Listen, when you have CEO pay at 200 and 300 times the average worker, I do think that's out of whack. This guy's pay was like 15 times the average worker. So this is not an outlier in terms of what he was making, although he has agreed to forego his $1 million salary and go down to this $70,000 base pay he's giving people. Listen, I love it when someone in a position of kind of respect and power wants to set an example like that.
I'd love to see something like this from Howard Schultz or like some other. I would like to see more CEOs follow in this path, though.
You know, the biggest example of this is Warren Buffett. His base pay at Berkshire Hathaway is $100,000. I repeat, $100,000. This is a guy who wants to set an example of not looking like he's being treated so much differently. Now, obviously, he's the second or third richest person in the world, but he didn't make that off pay.
Right. Well, they
off stock options.
Speaking of stock options, what if this people at this company, you know, could have done way better with stock options than a $70,000 salary?
People in. I mean, the Etsy IPO just went through the roof, right? So there are employees there who had stock options who are like in a good way, and talk about ways to ensure that your workers are loyal to you and take a stake in your company.
Can I ask one more question before we move on? And we will. But how do you feel if you're at that company now making $90,000 a year and now you're barely better paid than Jimmy in customer service? Because this has been a bigger question of people who are not on the bottom rung, but nearby, that we, this is maybe not rational, but we judge how we're doing by comparing ourselves to other people. So if now we're at minimum wage because you raised it up, I'm feeling relatively less happy.
Well, hopefully this is hugely successful, right? And other people follow suit, although I'm not holding my breath, you know, for that to happen. But I think one thing that's worth pointing out is that CEOs like Warren Buffett and others who take low salaries, their wealth is not derived, like you were saying, CR. He didn't get rich from $100,000 a year. And this guy, you know, it said he's got, you know, roughly $2 million a year in profits coming in right now. It sounds like the company's growing rapidly. I mean, this company could easily be worth $20-30 million. This guy is not getting rich probably on his CEO salary, but, you know, hopefully he gets rich by paying his employees more, and it's something that people follow.
Okay, so nobody here thinks that this is the wave of the future, as companies like this, but maybe an incremental sign or harbinger. And finally, I'll just remind you that this week, 21 protesters got arrested in Seattle for blocking an intersection near Seattle U, and they were part of a much bigger nationwide protest saying that Seattle's new $15 an hour minimum wage is the target, but it is just the beginning of a fight against inequity in America. We're going to be right back with KUOW's Week in Review. Stay with us. We never stop debating the news on KOW's Week in Review. Bill Finkbeiner and C.R. Douglas. And also with us, Hannah Brooks Olson from Seattle-ish. And our next top story this week, your state auditor, your watchdog. The person charged with keeping government accountable and transparent was indicted on charges of tax evasion, lying to investigators, and trying to conceal millions of dollars he allegedly stole from clients in his former business.
I did not break the law, and I want to be extremely clear here. I never, ever thought I was breaking the law. And I still do not to this day.
Part of Troy Kelly's brief statement about the charges against him. Now, we don't know whether the allegations are true, but we did know that there were allegations. When he ran for office in 2012, his opponent launched a website called factchecktroykelly.com with links to lawsuits involving Kelly. We elected him anyway. Bill Finkbeiner, you think this is more than an indictment of Troy Kelly. It's an indictment of voters and journalism.
Yeah, I really think, you know, we're seeing two things that are potentially leading us to more of this in the future. One is that the web has really gutted newspaper profits, and so they've obviously cut way back on their political reporting, focusing more on stories and issues that people want to see. The number of reporters in Olympia covering political issues in our state is probably 10% of what it was 15 years ago, and they just don't have time to dig into every issue. And then at the same time, the reason they're not doing it is because when they do write them, people don't necessarily read them, especially for these down-ballot races like Auditor. And we've been really fortunate in the past. We've had, you know, Brian Sontag, I think, did a great job with that office, and people sort of took the attitude, it's not broke, let's not fix it. A lot of this information isn't new, like you were saying, and we elected this guy anyway, and I think something was broke in that election. And I think we should look at, do we appoint these people? Does the governor appoint these people like they do in a lot of states, or do we keep running these elections? And if we do run these elections, we're going to have to figure out a way to really make sure people know who they're getting into these offices.
Well, let me push back a little, because investigative coverage has taken a hit. But on the other hand, the internet has made it easier than ever to click around and find out something about the person who is on the ballot. Is it an indictment of the voter? Is it your civic duty to know about somebody running for statewide office?
It is to a degree. I mean, you know, but in a perfect world, I guess we'd all know every judge that's on there, and we'd all know every ballot measure that's on there. But, you know, even when I was working in politics, I didn't know everybody that was on that ballot, let alone you're never going to have perfect information. So, you know, I think to say, oh, yeah, voters should have gone in and looked at the court case and tried to find out more about the sealed information in there and stuff, I don't think that's realistic. And I don't think it's, like, bad. I'm not saying, hey, you know, boy, the Seattle Times should go ahead and just pour a bunch of money into articles that people aren't reading and go down the tubes. But I think it's the reality is that everybody has cut back in their political reporting, except for CR here. You know, he's the last man standing out there. So, you know, we need more of that, because otherwise we're going to have elections where people are going to get in there that we really didn't know who they were.
CR, are you putting any more blame on the voter here?
Well, I want to defend journalism a little bit on this one, because this did come out in 2012. It came out late, a couple months before the election, early September. Seattle Times did a story on this. I think Spokesman Review. So there was an issue. There was really a cloud over Kelly during that last month or so of the election, but it wasn't so obvious how to use it against him. I mean, what we knew at that point was that he had been sued by a former business partner, and there were court documents of that case came out that was settled, a private lawsuit. These weren't federal investigators. These weren't IRS agents. There, of course, was no indictment at the time. There was no even inkling of an investigation. So what we had was allegations in court documents, which certainly damaged Kelly a bit. But even the Seattle Times, which looked into it, endorsed Kelly, saying he's a bit tainted, but we don't trust some of these allegations in the court case that's been settled and is behind him. So,
well, why do they endorse Kelly? What was so great about him?
Well, he had worked at the SEC previously as a sort of auditor. He had his own private business. He had been a state legislator. I think a couple of committees were sort of relevant to this work. The other thing is, he had a very flawed opponent. I mean, the Republican in that race was no one even the GOP was very excited about. So Part of the sort of lukewarm endorsement from the Times was, the GOP alternative isn't that great. So I don't blame voters too much it wasn't so obvious in retrospect how flawed this Kelly was.
Hannah?
It was also just a really complicated election. Like 2012, we were talking about before the show, like the state auditor's office is deeply unsexy when compared to everything else that was on your ballot in 2012. We were talking about marriage equality. We had a presidential election. Like
marijuana?
Yeah, marijuana. Right. Like so much happened that I think Bill's question about, is this even something that we should be putting to the voters at this point? Like a person in this position where even if the stories do exist, but they're just not as splashy as weed and marriage and a president, should we be putting these kinds of appointments in the hands of people who maybe it's their job to pay attention a little better? But I would say also as an internet journalist that I will defend internet journalism. But it is true that it's really difficult to do comprehensive wall-edge coverage in a way that not only addresses these issues and maybe can dig into candidates like this, but then also make them relevant and clicky and to try and like
clicky,
get the public to care. It's so hard.
Okay, so not too much blame on the voters here. One last question. Troy Kelly, again, not convicted, just indicted. The governor said resign. He said, no, I'll go on a leave of absence. Around the table, what should we do with Troy Kelly?
I think that, you know, should the legislature impeach him? I think that might be a little premature on this. I think, you know, the mistake was made when we elected him, I think. Sure. And, you know, at this point in time, does it rise to the level of an impeachable offense? That's
all right. Give him a leave of absence.
I'm just confused as to why he would want to stay in. Like, if he now he's going to
be a paycheck.
Yeah, truthfully. But like Jay Inslee,
is it a paid leave of absence
again?
I assume so.
I believe so.
Oh,
I don't know why they would cut off his pay. I mean, they didn't cut off his pay when he allegedly also wasn't doing his job a bunch of the time.
Can you just say I'm going to go on a paid leave of absence?
Can if you're the state auditor.
Yeah, really?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I learned something. Any last words, CR, before we move on?
I think it's pretty tough for this guy to stay in the job. It's not just any state office. This is the state auditor who's entrusted with ferreting out waste, fraud, and abuse throughout state and local government. And look at the kind of allegations he's under. Not proved yet, but listen, there's such a cloud over him that his days seem to be numbered.
There's your last word. That is C.R. Douglas joining us from Q13 Fox, Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican State Senate Majority Leader, and Hannah, you're with Seattle-ish, which is a Tumblog about Seattle politics, drinking, obscenities, and cute animals.
Yeah.
Do elephants qualify as cute?
Oh, absolutely they
okay.
do.
Okay, then I know what we're doing in a moment on the Week in Review. Hannah Brooks Olson from Seattle-ish, and we're still arguing about impeachment. Okay, we're going to get back to that. We'll see what happens to Troy Kelly. Meanwhile, there was weeping outside the Woodland Park Zoo this week when the zoo loaded its two elephants into crates and then into a truck. This followed a long debate over whether the elephants belong in Woodland Park or any other zoo, or whether they should be retired in a wildlife sanctuary. Seattle City Council members were divided on the issue. It went to court. This week, a judge said Woodland Park Zoo did have the right to send Chai and Bamboo to the Oklahoma City Zoo. And so, with no public announcement, the elephants were loaded onto that eastbound truck, which made the zoo critics even madder. On KUOW's Facebook page, for example, Andrea says they didn't make an announcement saying, come see the elephants one last time. Make it a farewell event, she says. Jordan writes, Woodland Park Zoo is no different than SeaWorld. Orcas in a bathtub, elephants in a closet. And there are many, many calls on our Facebook page and elsewhere for a boycott of Woodland Park Zoo. I want to know, clearly Woodland Park Zoo did not please everyone, but do they deserve to be boycotted in all of this?
I don't know why anyone would expect that they would have a goodbye party. Why would they want to draw more attention to this than has already been drawn to the fact that A, this is happening at all, which, by the way, back to allegations that are not new. Woodland Park Zoo's treatment of elephants, this is a long tail story.
Right.
And then, two, that the fact that where they're going might not be any better. I'm not surprised at all that this is how they behave. What are they going to say? Like, oh, we're just sending them somewhere that also might be like deeply imperfect and not great for them. Of course, they didn't have an announcement.
It's understandable, but was it another level of outrage?
Yes. I mean, listen, these elephants have served their country well, if you will, for decades. And it's as though this great employee has, after 35 years of service and heading to retirement, and there's no party. I mean, the least they could have done for being the star attraction for so many years was to open the zoo free for a day, a weekend, something, and, you know, allow kids, everyone, to go say their goodbyes to these animals.
But would it have been a party, or would it have been a protest with paint splashed on elephants? And, you know, really, would it have been a grand, a fond farewell?
Might have been all those things, but so what? Do it.
Yeah, they've been really trying to keep themselves out. Like, Woodland Park Zoo has been doing a lot of, like, cleaning up after themselves. And so I think they're just hoping everyone will forget and then be like, new tigers are coming. Yay.
Well, they made this mess.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
They let this go on too long, and it got to a level where it got to be a circus, if you will. So they are to blame for the problem, I think.
So you're saying elephants can leave behind a mess that does need to be cleaned up. If
yes.
I get okay,
they Bill at least deserved a gold watch or something mm-hmm. for their retirement.
A huge watch, yes, Bill.
Why does Oklahoma City keep taking our stuff?
Yeah,
what's up?
Right. So the Woodland Park Zoo, they're supposed to know at least what they think is best. I mean, several city council members and the mayor of Seattle said this is a decision for the zoo. I understand the disagreement. There's a debate, right? Lots of people saying they need way more room than is in a zoo. They should be in a sanctuary. On the other hand, the zoo says there are no Asian elephants in this California sanctuary that don't have tuberculosis. And there's a back and forth about it. But did the Woodland Park Zoo, are they guilty of something beyond just, well, you made a call that I didn't like, but you deserve to be boycotted?
I don't think so. Listen, the science is mixed on whether a sanctuary is best or a well-curated zoo. Oklahoma is a better zoo than Woodland Park for these elephants. There's a herd there. There's a bigger space. There's some undercover area. All the reasons why they are going to be better off in Oklahoma. I think the reason the council didn't weigh in is because of that. It's not a clear-cut case. And also, the zoo is a quasi-independent entity. They get some money from the city, but they're run privately. So it would have taken a real egregious error for the city to decide to step in and say, hey, you're wrong here. That would have been a complicated intervention, and there just wasn't a sense that this was the worst thing, so they didn't go that way.
Okay, don't boycott. Others?
I mean, the Woodland Park Zoo has a long history of also, like, conservation efforts, and they do other good work, I think, and they...
And they seem to sincerely believe that a zoo is the best conservation effort. It's the best public outreach effort there is for an animal we love.
I don't think they, like, hate elephants. I don't think they're mad at the elephants. And so I don't know that a boycott is necessarily the right thing. But I understand why people are upset, but I also understand why they're just really hoping this just goes away.
Bill, last word?
Yeah, I think there's a real public benefit to... especially for kids to, you know, to see the animals that are in the zoo. And boy, as someone who, you know, grew up in this area and spent time at the zoo as a kid, it's made incredible strides forward. So, you know, I think they'll keep doing that. And I definitely think that there's real value in going to the zoo.
Does this end with the elephants? Because there's plenty of other big animals that don't look that happy at any zoo.
I think it does end with the elephants. I mean, listen, the ground has shifted on how to treat elephants. Ringling Brothers Circus is now phasing them out. So it's pretty clear there's movement on this. I think there isn't the same movement on any of the other animals in captivity right now.
Yet.
Right now.
Right now. Meanwhile, the advocates, so people wanted to send Cheyenne Bamboo to a sanctuary instead, say they are not done fighting this. So we'll watch. As of this broadcast, they're still on their way to Oklahoma City, as is so many good things about this town. It's KUOW's Week in Review, and we're going to get right back at it. Stay tuned. We're debating, we're deciding, we're analyzing the week's top stories with former Republican Senate Majority Leader in Olympia, Bill Finkbeiner, Hannah Brooks Olson, writer at the website Seattle-ish, C.R. Douglas, political analyst at Q13 Fox. I'm Bill Radke. After an outbreak of measles and whooping cough that has sickened hundreds of people, school districts across our state and even the Washington legislature considered measures to get parents to vaccinate their children. This week, Spokane Public Schools went the farthest yet. The district pulled 143 students, kids, out of class because they could not prove they'd had their shots. Should Seattle and every other school district be pulling kids out of the classroom right now who don't have immunizations? Anyone say yes?
Well, let me first say that I thought Spokane did this in a very commendable way. They gave a ton of notice. I mean, months of notice, all kinds of parental notifications, phone calls, mailers. They had vaccination clinics. They had, you know, tables where you could get your waiver forms. I mean, no one could say they didn't see this coming and had all kinds of chance to either get the waiver or get the shots. And listen, they're trying to head off a measles outbreak or a mumps outbreak, and it is state law to have a vaccination or some waiver signed. So my hat's off to them. Would this work in Seattle? It's a bigger district. It's more complex. You know, I don't see why other districts shouldn't be doing this too.
You can get a waiver from immunizations if you've got a medical reason. There are allergies involved. If you have a philosophical objection or if you have a religious objection, an attempt to narrow those waiver options failed in the legislature this year. So you're saying Seattle, you're not sure. You don't know if it would work here. Does anyone think that Seattle ought to follow Spokane's lead?
I mean, the waivers leave such a big loophole for people. And so you really, it's mostly a question of getting your papers in order and figuring out sort of the logistics of how you're going to do what you think is best for your family.
Right.
It's not as if all kids who are not immunized are just being like yanked out of school immediately. Like, that's not what's happening here.
That's right.
And so I could see a push like this happening in Seattle, where really what you're doing is ensuring that you know what's going on with kids' health and that other parents are made aware, too. If other parents whose kids are immunized but who are concerned about a measles outbreak, who are concerned about herd immunity, I think it's also an awareness campaign for parents who have made the decision to vaccinate or for the parents who haven't to decide what the health risks are and also to maybe change their minds or to at least figure out why it is they're doing what they're doing. And if nothing else, maybe this prompts research on behalf of parents when they're filling out their waivers. They're like, why am I against this? And so I don't know why a push to get parents across the board more educated and more involved in this would be a bad thing. So yeah. I'm in favor. I think it would be hard. Seattle Public Schools obviously has a lot else on its plate right now. So that would also make it difficult. But I could see it working.
Bill Finkbeiner?
Yeah, it'll have even more on his plate if they get a measles outbreak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
really?
I think, you know, as Hannah was saying, I think with the options to opt out for philosophical reasons, that's pretty broad. And I think it's an issue, obviously, you know, just people remember less and less what these diseases did to people. And it's something also that is sort of the tragedy of the commons, right? I mean, it's like if everybody else is getting vaccinated and I don't have to. But as soon as enough people start taking that attitude, then they're putting everybody at risk. I think it's totally fair thing to say you can't go to school here unless you've either filled out the paperwork or gotten immunized.
We eliminated measles back in, you know, as recently as 2000. So it's back kind of, I wouldn't say surging, but it's sort of back on the rise. So,
and pertussis too.
And kind of nipping it in the bud, if you will, with these kinds of efforts are important.
There's also a real concern for marginalized community and obviously families who live in poverty, where if they maybe haven't been vaccinated previously, you know, if you have a vaccine clinic there available, like you're also putting this as an option to people who maybe couldn't afford it before and who are at the mercy of people. You know, we know that people who don't vaccinize by choice tend to be wealthier. And so you're also sort of putting people living in poverty at the mercy of other people's decisions. And so I think making it available within the schools, too, as part of this push can be really great for public health.
The consensus I'm hearing on this panel is you have enough reasons to get a waiver. If you're given the chance to get the waiver and you're still not vaccinating your kid, that's your right, but not in public schools. Right. And maybe this will come to Seattle. Bellevue Lake, Washington will follow it. On KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, we're continuing to analyze the week's news. And wow, a swarm. There are more candidates for this open city council seat than bees on I-5. We're going to get right back to it. C.R. Douglas, Hannah Brooks Olson, and Bill Finkbeiner, and I'm Bill Radke. Let's talk about this city council race, which I was reluctant to talk about because I'm not sure how much our listeners care, but I think you're going to make me care, CR. This is the question is, how hard should it be?
44 of them care.
At least 44 people, and they're all listening right now.
44 people for not the actual city council race, but to fill in for the seat that Sally Clark vacated.
Here's what happened. City council member Sally Clark said she's not going to run again. Then she said she's leaving early so she can take another job. In that situation, the city council, right, appoints their new colleague. This week, the application period closed, and there are 44 candidates. Some former council members, business people, an assistant principal, a Metro Transit bus inspector, a male model, etc. It is, as you say, Hannah, only a temp fill-in job. C.R. Douglas, why should we care, make me care about who sits in for 8 months?
Because it's not just any position. This person will be chairing the committee that Sally resigned from, which is the Housing and Human Services Committee. And there is no more important committee in the next 8 months than that. The mayor has teed this up as his next big issue, post-minimum wage. He's got a task force that's set to recommend all these different ways to make housing more affordable within the next few weeks. And those recommendations will fall on the lap of this person. This person is going to have to deal with things like, should we charge developers for building and use that for affordable housing? Should we upzone certain areas? Should the housing levy be more? I mean, this is going to be the issue of the spring and summer of these housing affordability recommendations. You need someone who can sit in this chair and deal with all that and put that whole thing together and come up with something that the council can support. So it's not just any council member they're looking for.
And can this person stand for election in the fall?
Well, technically they can, but what they are asking for unanimously, really, of the current council members is that this person not seek the office, that they only be a caretaker. And most of the applications they got are caretaker type people. They're not going to choose someone who's going to actively run.
Right. And I mean, that actual seat is another one that's like pretty hot as far as there's a lot of candidates for it. Anyone who was trying for this position would also have to, like, there's the whole districting thing. And so it's a really complicated sort of situation. And I think it would be really hard to take this temp position and also run a campaign because it would be like during the height of campaign season. So
they have to find someone highly qualified who also has a medical, philosophical, or religious objection to running for office in Seattle in the fall.
Just who wants to like try it on for size, or in the case of maybe, you know, Jan Drago or someone who was previously sat on the city council just really misses it.
Right. But, one more time.
Yeah. Right. But like CR was saying, I mean, Sally Clark has been someone who has been sort of a pivotal role in a lot of votes for various things. And we've seen sort of in the lead up to the encampment vote, there was this whole situation of would encampments be permitted in single family neighborhoods or not. And we've seen one vote really change the course of various pieces of legislature. It's not as if the next 8 months nothing interesting is happening. And so, I mean, that person can really decide some stuff as basically a temp hire.
Yeah, I got a different perspective.
Really? Tell me.
I think
so far I was being convinced.
Yeah.
This is the housing is going to be hugely important. This matters a lot, Bill Finkbein.
Right. Yeah. I'll do my best here, Bill. I think two things. One is this sort of idealized person who really understands all this stuff and can step right in and work everything out. My experience is that person doesn't exist. Number one, and number two, I think that, you know, this idea that, well, they're really going to not run for re-election, or at least that's what they're going to say when they're appointed. I mean, they're not going to sign an oath, and it's not going to be, you know, any more of a commitment, you know, than any other that politicians make. And so I don't think, you know, we should be super shocked if this appointee doesn't end up running for that seat because they'll have a huge advantage. And, you know, my experience is that for appointees to political office, what you see is people who are highly connected, people who are in a position to do some kind of favor for the people who are appointing them, because you've only got 9 people. And, you know, their personal interests are going to weigh heavily on who
wait
they appoint.
Wait a minute. When we talked about the state auditor, Troy Kelly, and how he got
I
in.
I was hoping you weren't going to see a theme.
Yeah. Just a second. When you said, when we had the state auditor who had charges against him, you said, man, we don't know enough to elect a down ballot race like that. We need appointees. And now are you telling me the last thing we need is appointees?
No, I'm not saying. Yeah, I'm saying, well, in this case, I think it's a little bit different. I think the auditor is a little more of a technical position. I think it's actually not as high profile even as the Seattle City Council. I think voters are going to be reasonably informed. I actually think in this case, what we should do is we should make filling in an office, we should make it like jury duty. Just pick somebody off the voter rolls. I'm serious.
You're serious.
I am absolutely 100% serious, because I think that when appointees get in there, they really are beholden very much to the people that appointed them. They generally, even if they say they're not interested in it, they're generally very interested in reelection. And, you know, this is, you know, as Hannah was saying, this is only for the rest of the year. This isn't, you know, for 5 years. I actually think that you could do just as well, because, again, I think that you've got a very limited cohort of people who are going to select somebody who either they owe a favor to, or they're on their staff, or they're going to be able to help them somehow in their reelection.
And wow.
I'm just not a big fan of the appointment process when it's done by committee. It's very different in my mind for the governor appointing the auditor, because okay. He's the executive of the state, and arguably the auditor's office is part of the executive branch. I mean, I think you can argue appointments either way in the auditor. You know, I think there's definitely a counter argument to it, but okay. I think it's worth looking at, you know, again, based on that race. But for this one, I think an appointment by a committee is a bad idea.
Okay, we're going to move on, but we just have a giant disagreement here. We just went from this is a crucial appointment to, that I just pick someone at random. So who wants to give us the last word with a rebuttal?
Well, I will say that Bill brings up a very good point, which is that one of the people who's going to be really key in this is Tim Burgess, who is also himself running for re-election and also himself has some real agendas regarding these sorts of decisions moving forward. He is running up against some very high-profile people. John Roderick is one of them. And so he's going to want someone sort of in his corner who gets brought in. Yeah. However, there is a degree of public commentary that's available for this. I think there's at least one like public forum where people get to go weigh in. So if you really do care about this, like, show up and talk about who it is that matters to you, because as much as the person who gets brought in might be beholden to the person who brings them under their wing, they're also going to be beholden to their constituency. And so that's the voting public.
Okay. I don't know when that public forum is, but don't let gutted newspapers tell you. Go online and find do a Bing search.
I'll tell you. It'll be on Seattle-ish.
It'll be on Seattle-ish. Okay. Nice plug. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and we'll continue to analyze the week's top stories when we come back. KUOW's Week in Review with independent C.R. Douglas from Q13. Can I call you a liberal, Hannah?
I would say that's an accurate description.
Liberal Hannah Brooks Olson at Seattle-ish. Republican Bill Finkbeiner, former state Senate majority leader. Washington State has no income tax, but we could still tax the wealthy. Olympia Democrats are pushing for a new capital gains tax for Washington State's highest earners. C.R. Douglas, how rich would you have to be to pay this?
I think it hits the top 3 or 4% of Washingtonians, maybe even less than that. You got to be pretty rich. Listen, this has almost no chance of happening. It's very theoretical. The state Senate, controlled by Republicans, is adamant against this. I'm not even sure Democrats have the votes in the House to pass it. So it's teetering at best.
Well, maybe we'll start a public outcry right now on one side or the other and push the lawmakers off the fence.
Well, perhaps.
What should we be thinking about? How do we decide this? Should we, you know, no income tax, that's been clear. What about a capital gains tax? Is it any different? Is it just as good or bad?
Well, Republicans would say no, and I think they're winning the branding battle here. They're basically saying this is an income tax.
Okay.
It's, you know, walks, talks, quacks, looks like an income tax. And if they can win that branding, they will have won the war, and I think they are, because the voters of Washington have turned down income tax, what, 4 times at least. So there's basically no appetite for that. I think Democrats knew that. I think they had to do something. They have a lot of constituents they got to please, be that public teachers unions, you know, public employees unions. I mean, they could not have presented a no new taxes budget.
Mm-hmm.
It
okay.
was not possible for Democrats. They had to do this, even though they knew they probably might have to live with a no new taxes budget at the end.
Well, we have a Republican right here, Bill Finkbeiner. We were just talking about the wave of support for a higher minimum wage and less income inequality. And do you think there's enough wave for there to be any interest in a capital gains tax in Washington?
I really don't, because I think CR is right that, first of all, you know, to justify it, to say we need to give higher wages to public employees, so let's, you know, institute a capital gains, I don't think that's going to fly. I think if it was tied to some other possible programs, it might have had more support. I personally, kind of off brand here, but I actually think capital gains tax makes sense.
Excuse me?
I know, yeah. Well, I think, you know, income tax is taxing wages, right? capital gains tax taxes investments. And right now, capital gains tax at the federal rate is significantly lower for most of the people who are paying it. It's significantly lower than their income tax rate. And I think that there's a good case.
So you're saying it's a more true tax on the rich than
income taxes? Yeah, I think it's a tax on wealth, and income is really a tax on effort.
So why can't that be sold to Washington state voters?
Well, people don't like to pay taxes. You know, I think that justifying instituting a capital gains tax without either saying, okay, we're going to decrease the sales tax or we're going to decrease the B&O tax doesn't make any sense, especially if you're saying, and the reason we're going to do that is to increase wages for state employees, which are already going up under the Republican no new taxes budget. So I think that's crossing that hurdle. I'm not saying that there's no impact on it. I'm just saying if you're going to look at new taxes, I personally think the capital gains tax is the one that would, you know, could make some sense.
Even the Republican. What about you, Hannah?
Oh, I believe in putting a tax on wealth. I mean, Washington State has this horrifically regressive tax system, and we keep running into these problems where we can't fund the things we need. We need the things. And so the question is, either do you raise taxes on people who it's disproportionately important in their lives, how much money they make? You know, sales tax is really regressive because it disproportionately impacts people living in poverty or living with less money, whereas sales tax is not that big a deal to people who have really a lot of wealth, whereas a tax on their wealth might help sort of even out our tax system and also put much needed revenue into our system. We have all these things we can't fund: education, rail, transit. And so we either have to figure out new ways to fund them or we have to keep going without them. And I think no one's happy with the idea of going without them.
Republican Bill, do you also agree that our regressive tax system is a bad thing for Washington State?
I don't think there's any perfect tax system. I mean, you know, any tax is going to cause pain to people. I think, you know, there's been a ton of debate. I mean,
But the regressive system we have, is that especially bad?
I don't think it's hugely, especially a whole ton worse. I think, yeah, it's more regressive compared to some other states, but I don't know that shifting, you know, the alternatives that I've seen for the most part, you know, aren't going to make a massive difference. I've never seen any Democrats say, let's decrease the sales tax. And I don't know that shifting to an income tax is going to be much better. And the people who are opposed to the capital gains tax bring up a good point, which is it is very volatile. California found that out in the last recession, and it is difficult to sort of build a budget around. But as far as being a fairer tax than the sales tax or an income tax, in my mind, the capital gains tax is that.
Okay, the Republican supports a capital gains tax, and we all agree it won't happen, not this time around.
That's
right?
Pretty accurate.
Okay.
Yep.
Next, a few weeks ago on this program, we told you about a new invention, powdered alcohol. Add water, and you have reconstituted vodka or rum. It's called Palcohol, made by a company in Arizona that says it will sell Palcohol nationwide this year. The problem is powdered alcohol would be easier to smuggle into, say, a concert. But should Washington State ban the substance? We talked about this a few weeks ago. Every one of our panelists said, no, don't ban it. This week, the State House said yes by a vote of 91-6. Overwhelming. So I ask you again, should your state Senate agree and ban Palcohol, Hannah?
Boo.
Boo on the ban?
No. No, you should not ban. So first of all, one, Washington State has a real puritanical history of taking away everything fun, right? I don't get Four Loko anymore. Now you're telling me I don't get to maybe at some point in my life enjoy Palcohol.
We gave you marijuana.
I guess. That's pretty great. But like, there's this issue where it's not even in the markets yet and we're already like, oh, get it out of here. Whereas there are things that do exist on the market, vaping and e-cigarettes, right, that are super easy for teens to gain access to. So I think if you're going to like pearl clutch and start stealing things away, start with what's already here and then like see what happens. Give Palcohol a chance.
Tell me, why is this that now this is four Week in Review panelists in a row, even liberal Hannah, going libertarian and saying don't ban this stuff, and it was 91-6 the opposite direction in the House?
Because think of the children. Think of the children. That's a powerful vote.
Yes, it is.
Well, and I'm slightly sympathetic to the ban. Listen, most states are banning it, at least most states that have kind of addressed the topic. I think there's a lot of questions about the safety of this stuff. You know, can you spike someone's drink easily? Can you OD, if you will, by putting too many packets in? Access to kids, I don't know, people worried about kids snorting it. I mean, there's all kinds of questions about this that I don't see the kind of raging need to put this on the market really quickly. I feel like we are the vanguard when it comes to experimenting with legalized pot. great. Why don't we see how that works? Other states are looking to us for that. Let another state be the vanguard on powdered alcohol, and let's see how they do it and the rules they come up with. We can always come around in 3-4 years and decide to introduce it after having learned how other states have dealt with it.
Okay, 30 seconds. CR just made it sound pretty scary. Bill, Hannah, are you convinced?
It sounds
pretty
scary.
You're wrong,
right? Except it's all pretend. I mean, nothing's happened yet. It's like we're scared of something that nobody is like, has anybody ever seen somebody abused by alcohol? Has anybody ever seen somebody?
CR just told you how it could be abused.
It could be abused, but nobody.
Well, the problem is it's not out in the market.
Yeah.
So you're right, theoretically.
So you're stopping a problem that's never existed. And I think the reason it was 91-6 is because most of them weren't paying attention. And then the rest of them, you know, were hoping they'd get quoted on the story because it's been in the news so much.
This is a former lawmaker talking about lawmakers like this. All right, KOW's Week in Review, Think of the Children. We'll be right back. Actually, I have to think of the children this weekend. Tell me, what would you do in this situation? This week, the Mariners star Robinson Cano committed what he says is the dumbest mistake he's ever made.
So Rodriguez walks one, and whoops, coming down from third, and Robinson Cano is tagged out. So Cano appears bewildered. Maybe he forgot how many base runners. Yeah, he's jogging in. And the Dodgers can't believe it. No, anybody else can either. So Robinson Cano forgot how many men were on base. That's a really embarrassing moment for a very good player. That is what the baseball people call a rock. And that was a giant rock.
A rock. I'd never heard of that before.
Good one.
But I have to think of the children because I'm going to see Robinson Cano tomorrow morning. He's going to be shaking hands at opening day of my kid's Little League game. So what do I do? If I'm an East Coast fan, I mock him relentlessly, right? It's a form of love on the East Coast.
But you're not an East Coast fan. You're Seattleite.
And our players are not East Coast players. They're delicate.
And they're delicate?
Be kind to Robinson. I urge you to be kind to him.
It was mentioned, however, in that clip that he was a good player. What was not mentioned was that he is a very expensive player. So,
yeah, that's $25 million per rock, Robinson.
Even less reason to have made this
okay,
kind of mistake.
So I ride him in front of my kid just like crazy tomorrow, right?
I think so.
Be nice.
Don't do it, Bill.
Don't do it. We need him.
We need those guys back.
I'll have to decide in the moment. Yeah, we need him to be...
Get like, back on it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe you're right. Maybe I could destroy him.
I don't think, this is the thing. I don't think a stern finger wagging from you is going to do any good. So,
probably true. Let's help him get up off the floor of the American League West. Hannah Brooks Olson, writer at Seattle-ish, website devoted to Seattle news and culture, and cute animals, mouthy bras, it's all there. C.R. Douglas, Q13 Fox, our political analyst. Bill Finkbeiner, former state Senate majority leader, Republican lawmaker, and it's a pleasure to have you on Week in Review. Thank you.
Thanks for having
me.
We are on Facebook. We're on Twitter. Join us there. I'm Bill Radke.